Almost 1.5 billion new garments are imported into Australia every year. In comparison, local production accounts for a mere 3% of clothing sales. But demand for Australian-made garments is growing. What can be done to help designers achieve their dreams locally? Hello, and welcome to Season 2 of the Critical Fashion Studies podcast. I'm your host, Dr. Harriet Richards. I'm a lecturer in the School of Fashion and Textiles at RMIT University and co-founder of the Critical Fashion Studies Research Group. In this episode, we're talking to the director of Sample Room, Julia van der Sommen. Based in Collingwood, Julia and her team support local designers with a range of services, from pattern making to manufacturing. Before we get started, I'd like to acknowledge that this episode was recorded on the unceded lands of the Woiwurrung and Boomerang language groups of the Eastern Kulin Nation. We pay our deep respect to First Nations elders past and present and to any Indigenous listeners tuning in. Thank you so much, Julia, for joining us. To begin, can you tell us a little bit about Sample Room and the services that you provide?
Sure. Thank you for having me. It's wonderful to be here. So I started Sample Room in 2009, and it's primarily a development house. So I'm by trade a pattern maker, and we have sample making, grading and specification services. And we also introduced a small run production, really as a need for our clients to find smaller run production at a time when the startup scene was very new to them. Mm-hmm. And we also have a very strong mentoring program called the Fashion Label Launchpad, which we introduced about 10 years ago as a way for people to learn about what was involved in starting a fashion label. Because with the rise of social media, all of a sudden people could have a very active brand, but they didn't actually know what was involved because they hadn't worked in the industry.
So really kind of tapping into this gap in the industry that you saw?
Well, we work with everyone in the industry. So okay. We work with big labels as well across all the department stores and other large labels that manufacture here and overseas. But we do have a large portion of startups because we've become known to be the place for people to recommend startups to go to, mainly because of the Fashion Label Launchpad program.
Right, yeah. I think that's a really interesting thing as well, that there's a lot of people maybe wanting to start a small business but have never worked in the industry before, and so they don't know a lot about those hidden elements of the production process.
Absolutely.
And so maybe that's where you come in.
Yeah, and there are a lot of people who think that, you know, you can just buy a product from China and drop ship and that people are doing it all the time, so it must be easy. Mm-hmm. And it's not until they start they don't realise what their responsibilities are and what they need to provide for everyone else to do their job well. Otherwise, everyone's just frustrated.
Yeah. So are you then encouraging people to produce more onshore so that they have more control over that production process?
There are a number of reasons why we do what we do, and we are not opposed to offshore.
Yeah.
We work with people who do offshore, and we encourage people very much so to develop locally. Mm-hmm. So they have more control over the development process, better fit. They have ownership of their patterns. Mm-hmm. And so they can be more flexible, geo-flexible in their manufacturing. And so they can switch between maybe some local manufacturing and then a country that provides smaller quantity before building their way up. And they have consistency in their design and fit. Over the years with working with both local and overseas, because I've got extensive experience in both, I've seen the positives and negatives of both. And I guess my reason for starting Sample Room was because I was just so frustrated with poor quality workmanship, frustration with poor fitting of garments, the waste of product of large quantities coming in, the fault rate that was happening. And I also wanted to improve for myself, the culture of the business that I was working in, the control that I had to give the best outcome without being at the mercy of other people's skill sets. Also just to be able to have that stability in the work, which was still quite volatile in 2009.
Yeah.
So that's why I started Sample Room, and that evolved over time to really have very strong opinions in what works well and what helps people have successful businesses. And so whether someone is starting out or they're moving back from overseas or they're a large company looking to move local, the evolution of the industry to be more accepting of local manufacturing prices. And it's been really exciting. And so helping people evolve. And it's not just startups. I wish that I could have more people from the industry learn about local, because mm-hmm. they really are two totally different processes.
Absolutely.
And totally different industries. And until people realize that and how creatively flexible you need to be in a local manufacturing environment based on what we have available, mm-hmm. rather than expecting it to be the same as overseas.
Yeah, yeah. And I think that's, there's a couple of things there about the price point, which is very different from manufacturing overseas. And then, I mean, the quality, obviously, but also the constraints and challenges that come with producing locally as well. So, I mean, I think the services that you provide are obviously filling a gap for multiple avenues, you know, small, large, medium-sized, all sorts of different businesses, are filling a gap, I think, in what can often be a really challenging environment, especially for those startups and those new emerging entrepreneurs or designers. What other gaps do you see in the local manufacturing landscape? And this is kind of a thing that comes up quite often in conversations. Oh, we can't produce on shore because there's just all these things that we can't do here. But I'm not sure if you agree.
Well, I did think about this as a question. Yes, there are limitations, but I'd like to flip it around and say, what can we do for the industry as far as the manufacturers and mm-hmm. service providers so that they can provide for the designers?
Mm.
Because it's all very well to say, what can the manufacturers keep on doing when we're sort of a two-way street? It's a partnership.
Yeah.
It really is a partnership throughout the development and manufacturing process. So as far as a manufacturer, which, you know, even though it's a small part of our business, it sort of is a large part as well, it's consistency of work. The expectation to improve machinery, to bring staff on, to train apprenticeships is difficult when that's a huge cost in a very low profit industry without the commitment from people that they will continue year after year. You know, most other industries, for example, if you're in marketing, you get a year-long commitment from somebody. So you can invest, you can bring on staff. We don't know and have never really known what we have in 2 weeks' time.
Oh my gosh.
And it's a roller coaster ride, it's a game of nerves. And so having a bit more job security, I guess, or commitment from customers or just open communication would be really helpful. Mm. And that way people could invest in machinery if they knew that there was security of a job coming up for the next couple of years that would cover that cost. Because we don't have any of that. We really just fly blind and have to go on a bit of a whim and hope that we can find work. So, of course, no one's going to invest in a shearing machine if shearing's in season this year but could not be in fashion for 10 years.
Yeah.
It's just too risky.
Yeah.
And therefore, when it comes to people looking to work in the industry, we want people to work, but we also need to support the people that are going to employ them. So not flipping back to offshore at the just because it's all of a sudden freight seems to have come down, or understanding timelines and understanding that a manufacturing business works on an hourly rate. And so, yes, meetings are required, or you can't spend hours talking to someone for free mm-hmm. because that's the only way that they are making an income to cover their costs of rent and staff and the internet and power and whatever else it might be. And if those things are increasing, then the cost also increases.
Yeah.
But I just wanted to go back to the cost of offshore mm-hmm. versus onshore.
Yeah, yeah.
Because I've worked in both for a very long time and I have been in charge of many areas, managed businesses, and I've also seen the downside and heard from many people the downside of fault rates and the high price of freight. I think that people need to understand the difference in quantity and size of business and how that can affect you as far as offshore or onshore. Because if you're a large business and you're doing huge quantities and you're filling full container loads and you have a team of people overseas, then yes, maybe it is more cost effective. But there's a very small portion of the market, and a large portion of the market is trying to follow that price point, and it's impossible. And so therefore, manufacturing locally is often just as efficient cost-wise when all is said and done.
Right, yes.
And we do a masterclass called The True Cost of Offshore versus Onshore. We just did one last week. And that is a wonderful thing to really expose side by side, apples versus apples, what's involved. And we do them probably every 6 months or so. So there's always a wait list for the next one. And I love talking about that because mm-hmm. you can't argue with the numbers, and they're numbers from our business and from people that we speak to. And we do some real life scenarios of people who have come back from overseas because their fault rate was too high. And we hear those terrible, sad stories of the product that's going to landfill or the heartbreak that they thought they did everything right, even approving a pre-production sample, and then there's been a switch of fabrics at the last minute. And I just feel sorry for the environment in all of this. And also for people who they hold on to this poor stock because they just don't know what to do and it's too heartbreaking to let go of, but they can never sell it. And it's just not something to be taken lightly and something that really needs to change.
Yeah, that's amazing. So you mentioned before that the educational part of your business was not part of the plan necessarily. No. So where did that come from, that you now do these masterclasses, these amazing workshops?
Well, originally, and I distinctly remember the moment, we had a client, he was very creative. You know, he was the first person to introduce me to Pinterest when you had to be invited to use Pinterest way back then. And after 2 months, he said, "This is too hard, Julia. I just feel like I'm hitting a brick wall. People are asking me questions. I've got no idea what the answer is. I feel like an idiot. I'm just going to stop." And it broke my heart because I love working with these creative people. And I also thought, this is not very good for business. If people are going to stop after 2 months, when I saw the future for them, what can I do to help them move forward? And I'm a very systemized person. I'm a pattern maker, therefore I'm very good at seeing things as a big picture and breaking them down. And I really love doing that. And so I originally, the first fashion label launchpad was 6 people that would meet around a table once a month. And we'd just go through what they had to do each month.
Yeah.
And then that worked really well. Then people from interstate started asking. So then we did it via Skype. So we'd meet via Skype. And then, of course, then we recorded and went online. And I've recently re-recorded the whole huge program again to update based on the layers of knowledge that people need as we go further into it. Because my knowledge, I've been doing this technically for about 40 years because I started sewing before I was 10.
Oh my gosh.
And you forget what is intrinsically part of your DNA now and what people don't know.
Yeah.
But the layered approach of the education on top of the problem solving and being basically your production manager and catching those mistakes, because there are a million nuances to every single product and the pathway that you go down, it's not just a textbook pathway. It's an investigation and it's catching things before they happen. So we started that and it's been really successful. In fact, we have never had a startup outside that program launch, and within the program, we launch people every month.
Yeah.
It's just a very smooth pathway, and people come to us who have tried for years and we sort of swiftly move through the process and they say in shock, "Oh, we're here already."
Right. Okay.
So yes, it actually is easy. If you know what to do, it shouldn't be hard. If you've got the toolbox and you know the pathway.
Yep.
And then the idea is they just repeat that. We teach them to be the perfect client.
Yeah, right.
So they know how to prepare for a design meeting. Mm-hmm. They know how to order fabric or source it. They know about ratios. That's the plan.
So it not only makes their life easier, but it makes your life easier.
That was actually the whole plan.
Yeah.
And we love it. It's a wonderful community of people. And it's a very different culture than what people experience in the industry, where it's a real sharing culture.
Yeah.
And I think that really stems from the fact that there's no hiding any information, because if no one else is going to tell you, I'll just tell you.
Right.
So therefore, there's no need for anyone to hold anything back. Mm-hmm. And so really great friendships form, and there's a camaraderie between people in the same place, which we all know when you're starting a business, it's a very lonely world. So we have social catch-ups and Facebook community.
Really building a network too.
Yes.
And this point that you brought up about culture, this is something that I'm really interested in, especially when I think about our graduates going out into the fashion industry. And when we are considering how the local fashion industry can be rejuvenated or supported, I think a big part of that is the culture and getting students, graduates, into jobs where they want to stay or they want to be for a long time, but also creating environments that are attractive to them to go into. So, jobs that is an aging workforce, for instance, of machinists and other manufacturing kind of skills, capabilities across the industry. And so it's about how do we encourage our graduates to want to work in those jobs? And maybe it's about changing the culture. I don't know. What do you think?
Culture is a really huge one. And as I said before, it was really one of the key reasons why I started my own business. And the culture was changing rapidly. People were moving, still moving offshore in a big way. And with that comes a lot of stress, I guess, in receiving samples, timelines pending, incorrect samples, worried about shipping production that's incorrect. In our workroom, I'm very big on education. Mm-hmm. So we've got a lot of education systems. I record a lot of things. We have welcome documents for people so they can see for the first 3 months of their business manuals on exactly what they need to do. But the culture within our business is really important, that we are all on the same level.
Mm-hmm.
And I was just talking actually with my key person who's in my business about, you know, the workroom and how tight-knit we are, and that between a machinist or a cutter or a production machinist, it is exactly the same level. And I have moved people on if they have not been the right mm-hmm. culture, because I know that a bad egg can split the whole workplace. And I think the other big difference that we have in our workplace is that we are a team of technicians.
Mm.
So we don't have the hierarchy that a lot of businesses have.
Right, yeah.
And the hierarchy is quite damaging on a number of fronts. There's a lot of blame that happens in the industry, and it's hard to be blamed if you've got something that's out of your control.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think that having an environment where someone feels in control of themselves and their future in that environment and knows what to expect each day can have a really big impact on whether they – it doesn't matter if they're making a horse blanket or high fashion.
Mm-hmm.
It's a creative process, but it's really about feeling like they're doing a great job so they can be proud of that. And we're a little bit different in our business because we're not the label. We don't get to receive the accolades from people saying, you're that designer, or that's the business that you work in. You don't get to see the fashion parade.
Mm-hmm.
So we have to have a lot of pride in what we create, a beautiful pattern, a beautiful sample. And the relationships are really important. And I think that having external companies work with us, there needs to be more education about how to work as a team and how to respect people, no matter what they're doing in the industry, whether they are someone sewing a button on or somebody who is supplying fabric, having an understanding of how that business works and empathy for what they're doing in their day, to just be polite and nice, don't be rude.
Yeah, and just to support.
Quite simple.
Yeah, and to support everyone along the production process. How do you think we can improve that? It's a tough one.
It's a really tough one. And it's something that I talk to quite a few of the education institutions about. It's a thing at the moment for people who want to have their own business because they want to be their own boss.
Mm-hmm.
They don't want to be told by anyone. Mm-hmm. And I think there is an education that's needed on what that actually means, how to be a good business person in that, how you communicate, how you pay bills, how you respect people's time. There's a whole lot wrapped up in that. And I'm not sure how to do that.
Mm.
I try my hardest
with
some very nice but firm emails. And sometimes it is just about being, you know, within the business as well. I think the way that I create that culture is I do a lot of protection from other people in the team. And that's because I've been more experienced in this. And I'm also able to make the call because I'm the boss.
Yeah.
And that's easier to do that than expect. I wouldn't expect a junior to do that. So it's making that stand. And even though we talk within the team about how we're going to tackle certain issues, it is quite tricky. I can make the call whether we sack a client because they're rude.
Right.
And I'm more than happy to do that because I need to protect my interest of a team that is respected.
Mm.
And I can't expect anyone to take abuse on emails or phone calls and then still work for me, because that's my job. I'm like the mother hen, aren't I?
Yeah, yeah, exactly.
So helping people through that process, and also helping people manage that as far as, well, how would I reply to this?
Okay,
let's talk about this. So you're learning skills in how to manage difficult conversations and how to gain those skills.
Yeah.
So I don't know how to manage that externally.
Yeah, I know. It sounds like you're doing a great job of upskilling and like providing support and encouragement and, you know, creating a really supportive environment internally. But yes, the challenge is externally.
All we can really do is love the people who are wonderful and say goodbye to the ones that aren't.
Yeah.
And then they can learn from someone else.
Yeah. It's very poetic. And what about kind of other initiatives or investment or support structures? There's been quite a lot of talk, obviously, from the government about apprenticeship programs and so forth. Mm. What do you think of the place of those in the industry to build skills?
Mm. It's a very tricky scenario because it takes a long time to train somebody to be a beautiful machinist. I've met many a machinist, and we have a wonderful group now that are a mixture of skills, highly skilled in sampling, very methodical and can happily sit on the same thing all day, and people who need variety so that we chop and change. And we're a small environment in that we do small run production, so we need much higher skilled machinists, and we all our machining's in-house. We don't outwork any work, and that way we can keep control of it and we can do those smaller numbers. With the machinists, I think the first thing is to make sure that the environment the machinists are in is great. The machinery is comfortable, air conditioning, heating, that they can come to a workplace, because it's really physically hard. You know, somebody who's been a machinist for a long time, they'll have back issues, they'll have neck issues, because you are working quite hard lifting fabrics, moving things around, and it's a very time-based business.
Yeah.
So in order to give the designers what they need as far as price points and a business to survive, then everyone has to play a part. So making sure someone's quick and efficient. And that can be not just the machine or the machinist, it's the way the work flows through, the movement of pieces of work throughout the workroom. So we would all love to have a totally robotic factory where we had things fly through the air and drop in front of machinists so they didn't have to lift an arm. But that's
some pneumatic tubes or something.
Yes, exactly. That would be wonderful, but it's just not viable. But having that variety and showing people almost like a mixed workplace. So I think there's two sides to it, that we need to make sure that the job sounds attractive and not just to yourself, but when you're talking about it to other people, because saying that you're a machinist is quite different than an atelier or a creator, or just I work at Sample Room, or I work in the fashion industry creating garments for designers. That's a totally different conversation that can be like, oh, and not, oh.
Right, yeah. The tone is very different.
Very different, yes. So I think variety is needed. And look, there are people out there that really want to be a machinist.
Yeah.
And so how do we upskill that person who is wanting that job into having the speed and efficiency that's needed, because it's quite different than being a home sewer and being able to plod along. You know, it needs to be speed and economy of scale in what you're doing. So it's very hard as an owner of a business to be that person saying, you need to go faster. You need to do these 20 things in the next hour, because it's not a nice thing to have to say to someone, but then there has to be an understanding of expectation in a role.
Right.
So I think that's important. I think bringing in technology is going to be really important. But technology doesn't have to be, sure, we've got laser cutting machines and we don't have one, but we'd like one.
Shout out to anyone who wants to
donate one. But what about having translator equipment on the machine? So people who are worried about working in a workplace because they don't have strong English skills can still feel like they're part of a workplace. And that's a very achievable thing these days.
Right, yeah.
So we can... There's a lot of people that are at home, and we had a wonderful person working for us for a while. She was Syrian and her dad was from the industry, but he didn't want to come into the industry in Australia because his English, he wasn't confident. But he had amazing cutting skills, and cutters are another thing that so desperately needed in the industry.
Right.
So we have skills sitting at home, but we haven't quite bridged that gap yet. It's always been, well, we need somebody in the workroom who has the same language and then they can speak. But why not have another alternative, and then maybe have more of a culture where we can upskill people in their English skills in a caring environment that we can all learn?
Yeah, I love that. So much smaller scale initiatives that can actually have quite a significant impact rather than these big scale, you know, big policy changes and so forth.
And then if people are coming to Australia, and, you know, our migrants, then we have got, okay, here we have a pathway for you based on that skill, and we, your biggest fear of not going into an industry, we've dealt with that as well. So that's sort of one of the ideas that I've come up with. And then hopefully that they can then upskill. We're very fortunate in our workroom. We've got people from all different cultures. We've got a fantastic cutter, Sharon, who's been with us for 5 years. He's from Sri Lanka. And so he worked in the really big factories in Sri Lanka. So I often pick his brains about how do they do it there? And he would talk about having a training line of machinists. So they had, there was no pressure on them to actually finish an order. They were purely learning the machines and picking up the speed. And then as they reached certain milestones, then they would move into the production line.
Oh, wow.
Now, you need to be a pretty big business to support that. So while apprenticeships are wonderful, there needs to be sort of some vetting, because some people might never reach that point of being having the speed that's needed. You know, production is incredibly hard, and I think there might be an understanding that because people back in the 60s made a lot of money from clothing manufacturing that people are now, and it's just not true.
Yeah. And also highly skilled as well.
Highly skilled.
And I think that often gets forgotten that, yeah, as you're saying, even the cutting, it's an incredibly skilled job.
Absolutely.
And even though there's technologies like laser cutting, not everyone has access to that technology because it's extremely expensive. And, you know, you're often dealing with much higher quantities when you're using laser cutters and so forth.
Exactly. Exactly. So just offering the opportunity for people to see just what is available in the technical side. It's not just being a machinist, but you could have another role and then move over into that and think, actually, I quite like this. It's just being in that environment and seeing how it functions and how it works.
Yeah.
And that it's not a bad thing if you choose that.
Yeah. And I guess that's the thing with apprenticeships as well. It's almost like you then get onto a pathway and it's very difficult to then get off that pathway. Whereas if they're a bit more flexible, you might think, actually, pattern making is not for me. Yeah. I don't have a mathematical brain, but actually maybe the machinist role is much more for me or what have you. So
exactly. So I think with apprenticeships, I absolutely agree with them. And I think that we've got sort of a very finite time of having the teachers who know how to teach in the old school way, but probably needs just a bit more financial support.
Where do you think that should come from?
That is a really tricky one. I mean, the only real answer is the government, whether that's federal or state. There's been conversations around how the unions have a role in that too, because they have their hands on the pulse of what's going on and with manufacturers. And sometimes you have a machinist who has been a machinist in a particular role and that factory may close down. Say, for example, it was making laundry bags for the hospitals and they don't think they can move over to clothing.
Right.
And so how do we bridge that gap?
Yeah.
And what do we offer? Because that's a low-hanging fruit, as far as I'm concerned, to help people upskill because they have the fine hand motor skills.
Yeah, that's absolutely. What's really
important. So whether it comes from the migration category and helping people on that category, or people like who are out of work and they're in an age group that's hard to find work, can you upskill in that way? So there's sort of little pockets around.
Yeah.
And there's some people doing some really wonderful things in helping people upskill in that way and then how to take it to the next level.
Yeah. Yeah. Oh, that's so interesting too. It's not a one size fits all sort of thing. It's much more intricate, which of course is what the fashion industry is all about. It's so complex. Now, coming back to some of that education that you're doing, you're about to host a workshop on how to start your fashion business. And you've also produced a free booklet called 7 Myths on Getting Your Fashion Label Made Locally. Can you tell us a little bit about these resources?
So the Start Your Fashion Business workshop is really culminating all the information that people would like to know, but we don't have the time to tell them one-on-one. And it's a bit of a festival. It sort of goes for about a week and it dives into a number of different categories, whether it's what's possible to do in Australia, what isn't possible to do in Australia, what we do and what we don't do. We go into the costs involved because that's a really big one and everyone, it's an unknown for many people. Yeah. We go into what can go wrong and also what the skill set is that people need. And it's really a way for people to discover, is this right for me, before they take that first step and start investing the money. So we're starting that one on the 1st of May. And we love doing this one. We do it about 4 times a year. And it's a wonderful way for us to share our knowledge in a really wonderful, excited environment where people get all the information, the questions answered, and then we bed down and we start working with the people who we're working with.
So do people come in person or it's online?
It's all online.
Yep.
So you can anywhere in the world.
Anywhere in the world.
Yes. And we have a workshop on the Monday, Wednesday and Friday.
Okay.
And there's some bonuses for turning up live, of which one is a budget session.
Oh,
and so people get a lot out of that. And I'm told by people that this is the information they can't find anywhere.
Right.
And because we are doing the work, we can give them the actual facts.
How difficult has it been to shift the perception of startup labels and fashion designers that onshore is not only possible, but also potentially more sustainable?
There are a new breed of designers who are on board. Now, sometimes I think they're on board because they say it's going to be easier communicating, and that is true. It is hard with price points, and so that initial price point, which we go through in our True Cost Masterclass, because it's not just manufacturing price versus manufacturing price. And unfortunately, if someone doesn't know that, they only find out at the very end when everything's been made and everything's on the ship and you receive that bill at the very end and you open the box and then you realize oh, if I only knew this.
Yeah.
And that's why we try to educate as much as we can up front. And we also do that through our Instagram Live sessions every Wednesday morning. And we meet so many people who spend $20,000, $30,000, $50,000 and say, now I can't afford to do anything else.
Yeah.
And I think, you should have come to me first. So that's what we try and educate people in that way. So sometimes it is a matter of just showing. I think it's just showing the numbers.
Mm-hmm.
Showing the facts is the only way someone can really see that. Mm-hmm. And speaking to other people as well, because it is hard when you receive those invoices and you think, oh, is this actually cheaper or not? But I think starting off with somebody who can work through a strategy with you of what is the right product to make as well. For example, baby products are hard to make.
Mm-hmm.
People want to make baby products, but you're competing with such big companies that are doing huge numbers at low prices.
Low prices.
And parents don't want to spend a lot of money on something that lasts 2 months.
Yeah.
So it's being selective in what you actually develop to know what the market's willing to spend. And it makes me so happy when I see so many designers in Australia starting to introduce Australian-made product to test the market, whether they have a valid customer, and they do.
Mm.
And so it's normalised the price of local manufacturing.
Right.
And that's what I have loved seeing over the last few years. So whether that's Kew, Country Road, Aaron Williams introducing Australian-made product, Victorian Woods. There's a whole range of people. And so all of a sudden you can say, oh, I've charged the same as this person, this person, this person, and it doesn't seem weird.
Yeah.
And I think that that's really valuable for the local industry.
Yeah. And do you think it's important that those big established brands are open and transparent about the fact that they're making in Australia, that they're kind of shouting it from the rooftops?
Absolutely. Absolutely. And I love that they show dresses side by side.
Mm.
And so people can see the comparison and they can make that decision themselves. So I feel even for myself that I can feel a shift. For a long time, I have felt very uncomfortable spending under $300 on a garment because I know what's involved.
Yeah.
And so there's more people that are feeling very comfortable with that now. So I think it's really important that they show and they show why the cost is there.
Yeah.
Because then they can say, because this is made in Australia, this is the cost, which we're really passionate about. Their lower cost garments are mass produced, and that's probably what's not shown.
Yeah.
And if you think about it, you realize it. But if you don't, you'll say to somebody who's starting out, how come you're charging so much and they're charging so little,
mm-hmm.
but they don't realize how economies of scale have a huge effect in lots of areas.
Yeah. It's a good point. So as we begin to wrap up this fantastic conversation, this season of the podcast is all about celebrating the fashion community in Victoria. And we've already touched on the fabulous fashion community in Collingwood. But in your years working in the industry, I wonder, what do you think it is about Melbourne that inspires you and what makes it a place of vibrancy and creative energy?
I love, and I'm not from Melbourne originally, I'm from Adelaide.
Okay.
And so I've lived here twice. And I
That's
have,
good, an outsider perspective.
Yes, exactly. So I really see how wonderful it is to be whoever you want to be and you have a place to be.
Mm-hmm.
Now, Adelaide has improved in that way through the years. But it doesn't matter. So there's no like fashion trend that runs through. Mm. And so people will often come to me and say, I'm designing a range. And I say, who it's for? And they say, it's for me. Like, well, who are you? Because you could live two sides of the river.
Exactly.
And have totally different taste in what you wear. And I think that's wonderful. So the variety that I see in my job, it's inspiring. And I love being open to new things. I was introduced to walking meditation the other day, something I had never heard of. Someone's doing a range of clothes for people who do that.
Oh, wow.
And
amazing.
I thought, what is this thing? So I'm exposed to some wonderful, exciting, open conversations. And I think that that is a beautiful place to be when you can be whoever you want to be.
Mm. Yeah, that's always very inspiring. And finally, what does the future look like for Sample Room? You've given us a couple of tips on where we can go to find you and some of the workshops that you're running very soon. But what are some of the new projects or programs that you're running in the future?
Mm-hmm. Well, we're looking to introduce a membership very soon for those who have been in our fashion label Launchpad so they can continue with the support and pretty much like a production manager on call, I guess,
right.
And that community that's so important to guide them through into the future. We have a sister business called Pattern Room.
Yep.
And Pattern Room is a world first online pattern catalogue.
Oh, amazing.
We were in the States early this year and we're heading over to Europe in 3 weeks to both Munich and Milan to introduced that to the European mm-hmm. market. And that's been a really wonderful introduction to the printing industry, which sort of runs alongside fashion but operates in a totally different way.
Yeah.
And so the new printing technology that's coming out and the change in how we have been able to bring more uniqueness to our garments in small run production of prints, digital printing, some fantastic machinery that has been introduced just recently into Australia that people were investing in.
Oh, you amazing. Know?
So Left Bank Art Group in Queensland just bought a printing machine over $1 million.
So printing fabric?
Printing natural fibres.
Oh, wow.
Wonderful introduction that a lot of people were too scared to invest in. So I think that that needs all the support and encouragement we can possibly mm-hmm. give them, because they've taken that leap for the industry. So we need to give back to them and make that commitment to them as well.
Yeah, to use that facility.
Exactly. So Pattern Room's a really exciting platform to really, for me, it was to improve the fit of garments, mm-hmm. of those basic garments, because I have been through the frustrations of being a garment tech and sending a tech pack and going back and forth and then producing a garment that I can't even physically wear because the fit is so bad. And the frustration of that communication yeah. just meant just deliver it. So just trying to solve that problem for a lot of people, whether they're manufacturing locally or overseas. And this is not a local issue. This is an international
it
issue.
Is.
So we have customers from Alaska to South Africa and Lithuania and Guyana, and it's wonderful to speak to these people and hear their story, which is just the same story.
Mm-hmm.
So we're really excited to do that. And of course, the Fashion Label Launchpad, even though that is for startup designers, the Fashion Label Launchpad definitely has a place with established companies okay. and helping established companies upskill their staff mm-hmm. after they leave fashion school within yeah. the environment of their workplace so that they can be more efficient, they can get better quality product quicker, saving money, saving garments, saving the environment. Mm. So that's something that's sort of next in line for me.
Very exciting and very inspiring. Thank you so much, Julia, for joining us today. This has been such an excellent way to begin season 2 of the podcast. To all our listeners, thank you for tuning in. If you're interested in Julia's work, you can follow Sample Room on Instagram or visit their website. If you're listening to this episode on the day it comes out, there's still time to get your ticket to Julia's Start Your Fashion Business workshop starting on Monday, the 1st of May. We'll include all the links in our show notes. If you're loving this new season of the Critical Fashion Studies podcast, I invite you to join us for episode 2. I'll be talking to Denny Francisco, designer and founder of Nagali, about taking First Nations fashion design to the world. I also encourage you to subscribe to the series in your podcast app so you never miss an episode. As ever, a big thank you to Creative Victoria for their generous support, Thomas Phillips for audio engineering and co-production, Sanam Goodman for social media expertise, and Hugh Caldwell-Ross for our logo. See you next time.